Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And we would love to have you part of our conversation, so please listen, but also call with your questions or comments. Right now, all we have is the toll-free number. I can't get into the computer, so our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Mark, thanks for coming in. And we'll turn your mic on.
That would be nice.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, I can hear you. Can you not hear into your earphones?
No.
Okay, well somebody's messing around here before I get in. Anyway, so we've got plenty to talk about, and the first thing that I think we should get off the list are voles. We have, you said, an issue. The voles are bouncing back, and I'm really hoping that's not true, but it sounds like it is, because they were terrible several years ago in my garden.
It was about 3 or 4 years ago we had a real influx of voles that were doing a lot of damage in gardens, and it was kind of interesting to see gardeners bringing the damage in. You know, they're bringing samples in for me to take a look at, and they'd have a full-size beet that just had been nibbled out. So there was basically just a shell of a beet with no insides in there, and the voles had chewed everything else out and consumed it. So very, very interesting damage that the voles are doing, and they have really popped up in population just the last month or two. So we're really starting to see an influx of those right now. If you aren't familiar with what voles look like, they really look like mice, but they're a little bit more brownish gray.
Do they have stubbier tails?
They have really short tails, and their noses are much more rounded. So they've got kind of more of a rounded nose instead of a pointy nose, and really short tails on them as well too. And they don't run as fast as mice. They're a little bit slower. So my cat just has a
heyday. I was going to say, no wonder why my cat's not eating anything at all.
Yeah.
So he's outside
catching voles like crazy. Yeah, my cat's catching at least one or two, probably even more that we don't know about, per day right now. So
does he bring you any presents?
We get presents all the time. Yeah, so we get presents all the time. But they can really do a lot of damage in gardens. They like to tunnel under sidewalks, and I mean they'll find little places to make tunnels. If you go down to Black Hawk, the park down there where all the soccer fields are, there's little tunnels and trails all over the place, and it's all voles out there right now. And so they love to get in between the snow and the soil line in the wintertime when we get snow on the ground. So if your grass is left a little bit longer, the voles will just have a party out there all winter long, and the snow will melt.
Lots of insulation for
them. Yeah, yeah. The snow will melt in the spring, and you'll just have little trails all over the place going from one big nest to the next out on your lawn. So you'll have spots where they pretty much chewed down all the grass and worn it all off, and then trails running from each of those spots underneath your lawn. And there's no natural predators out there for them in the wintertime that can actually find them, because they're hiding underneath the snow. So they're well concealed underneath the snow. There's a ample supply of food with all the roots and grass and, you know, everything out there for them to nibble on. So they just have a grand old time out there in the winter.
And speaking of roots, they will just devastate your root crops if you leave them in the ground, which typically I would do because I like how they sweeten up and taste
absolutely.
Great. But a couple of years ago, I'd never had a vole problem before, and I'm going out to dig up carrots. I'm like, what the? Yep. Where's all my carrots?
Yep.
The tops were still there, but the bottoms were gone.
Carrots and beets, and they love turnips as well too. But you know, anything that's out there, they're going to be nibbling on that. So the best way to control those is to first start by mowing your lawn really short in the fall. You really want to get that mower down about as low as you can possibly get it, you know, down to about an inch. And, you know, a lot of people are starting to do that right now, but we're going to have some good weather for the next month or so. I mean, it's usually the end of November, first part of December, by the time we get some snow that's going to stay and it's going to stick around for the rest of the winter time. So if you mow right now, that's great. But you're probably going to need to mow at least another time, if not two more times, before we really get into winter.
So now is not the time to do your low mowing.
Nah, we've been dropping our mower down a little bit every time we mow. It really helps. Of course, you're picking up leaves and stuff as well, too. But it really helps get the grass ready for winter by starting to mow down a little bit closer. And you want to do that very last mowing right before it looks like it's going to snow and it's going to stick. And if you have a really short lawn, when that happens, there's less area for the voles to play in through the wintertime because there's not that big cushion of air, you know, insulated underneath there where they can run around and do damage all winter. So mow your lawn really close. Usually we will apply a repellent, a rodent repellent at that point. Very inexpensive. They do an excellent job and extremely safe for people to use as well, too. It's just made from castor oil. And so it's just a granule. It has castor oil applied to it. Voles, mice, squirrels, gophers, moles, they can't stand the smell of the castor oil, so they just leave. And they just go somewhere else. So they're less likely to get damage in your lawn that way. If you have had a problem in the past and it looks like they're going to be bad again this year, it would be a good idea to put some bait stations out there as well, too, so that they have another type of food source to eat.
Do you just purchase the entire bait station, or can you make one from PVC pipe?
Yeah, we've made them from PVC pipe. You can buy the stations already baited as well, too, so those work really nicely. But we'll take about a 2-inch round PVC pipe and just cut it into about 12-inch, 14-inch long sections. And then I've got some baits that you can put right inside the pipe. Inside the pipe, they're protected. So
you have a T in there? So a part of it's coming up, you can put the bait on the inside, or do you need to have that?
You could do that if you wanted to, but usually with the 2-inch pipe, it's big enough, you can just drop it right in the middle. The pipe protects it from the elements, so you don't have snow and rain and water getting in there causing damage. And then it also protects the bait from, say, birds coming in and getting into the bait.
Or
cats or dogs. I don't think the cats are really all that attracted to it, but dogs might be. And birds definitely would be. And so it protects, keeps it in a well-protected spot so that you don't have those other animals getting into them. We don't want to target anything other than what we're trying to control, which is the voles. And it works really well on mice as well, too. So that type of bait's very effective. You can do the bait stations, put one underneath the deck and one along the side of the shed and one out underneath a couple shrubs and put it in strategic locations around the yard where the voles and the mice might be able to find it and do a very good job for you.
So one concern I would have, though, even though the cats can't get into it, if the cats are eating the voles, what kind of problem could that be?
Yeah, the way most of the rodent baits are now is they're only first generation. And so the first critter that eats it will be affected by it. But subsequent animals, if they eat them, they will not be nearly as affected by them. In fact, they'd have to eat many, many of them all at once for it to be a problem.
Okay, because I know my cat, every morning he wants to go out the back door and he heads straight for the chicken coop because he sits patiently outside a certain hole to watch.
Waiting for something to happen. Yeah. So the way a lot of the new baits have been formulated is they're much more effective first generation and much less likely to damage second generation if somebody were to come along and eat a vole or a mouse that had consumed a poison already.
And the concern for us it would also be the chickens, because the chickens, they'll go after a mouse if they can get to it.
Yeah. So much, much safer, but still very effective on the targeted pests that we're trying to get. So between the mowing your lawn short, the repellent, and the bait stations, it's working very nicely.
I know when I have gone to church in the spring, the early spring after the snow piles have melted.
Yeah.
And especially if your chapel happens to be on the edge of town.
Oh, yeah.
You just see tunnels all over underneath the snow.
If you've got a field next door or, just open lot or just some open areas where they're hanging out, this is when they're going to be looking for a nice new place to set up shop for the winter.
So how can you tell their populations are building again?
Just the amount of people that are coming in saying that they've got problems, and when my cat's catching them every day. We've got a lot of open fields around our place, and so the population is growing.
I knew I had seen that several years ago. I thought, okay, something might be up because I was seeing tunneling going on at the periphery of the garden one year, and then the next year they were all
right in there. So and the interesting thing about voles is they reproduce at about a 30 to 40 day cycle, and so you start with two, and
there's about five generations
in November. Yeah, you can have hundreds by the next spring.
Just say no to voles. Although they are really good for owls, but I'm not ready to give up my garden produce for the owls.
I don't think I want to feed the owls quite that much. We've got hawks down our neighborhood too, so I know they're helping with the population as well. But good mouser. Good cat, you know, take care of a lot of those. We don't have too much trouble on our property because our cat's really taking care of them.
The other issue I deal with though with that is my cat's outside, but how's my songbird population doing outside? So I get help on one end, but then they take it on the other. So and every once in a while I see little piles of feathers. Not too often,
not
unfortunately,
too often,
but it's like.
Yeah.
Dang, there goes another one.
Yep, it happens. It definitely happens. So
you're listening to the Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is my guest. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So we were talking about voles and voles in the lawn. So while we're still on the lawn, now's a good time to aerate?
Yeah, very good time to aerate. In fact, there's probably no better time of the year to aerate. It does less damage to your grass. Your grass is going into dormancy. Most of the time you see people out aerating in the spring, and that's when the grass is coming out of dormancy and really starting to grow and starting to take off. And it actually does a lot of damage to the grass in the springtime because you're ripping the root system out, you're putting holes in there, opens up an area for weeds to germinate and grow. I mean, think about it. When you're pulling 2-3 inch plugs out of the soil, and you're leaving a gap where there's nothing. And so there's a very good chance that you're going to have weeds popping up in some of those spaces. I mean, the gaps in the soil really help the root system of your grass expand and spread out. I mean, it's very beneficial for your lawn, but it opens up an area where there's no grass. And so where there's no grass, that's where the weeds like to take off. So by aerating in the fall, you're much less likely to get weeds sneaking into your lawn in your aeration holes. It's also a very, very good time to overseed with some new grass. If you're introducing new grass into those areas where you've aerated, then the seed has a place to germinate and grow. So instead of getting weeds coming up, we've got new grass coming up in those areas. And there's some great new varieties of grass you can incorporate into an older lawn and rejuvenate the lawn, help it so it doesn't need as much water. It tends to be much less prone to getting insects and diseases as well, too, because they resist insects and diseases. A lot of the new varieties of grass, much more tolerant of insects and disease damage. And
they germinate in the cooler, cooler temperatures?
So right now, like a turf-type perennial rye would germinate in probably 10 to 14 days. It is starting to cool down, so we're kind of on the tail end of the season for planting grass, but definitely could get some nice germination, especially with the way the weather looks like it's going to be for the next week. I mean, it looks pretty good. We've had really wet last couple, 3 weeks or so.
So there's good soil
moisture.
Yeah,
so there's good soil moisture. And if we get some nice warm temperatures, we can get that grass seed to germinate and come up. So that's a very good thing to do about the time you're aerating. And also winterizer fertilizer. You know, fall's the best time to fertilize your lawn, get it prepared for next year. We've gone through a really hot, dry summer, and it's been very stressful, difficult for a lot of yards. And to perk that lawn back up, get it looking good again, aeration would be great, and then throw a winterizer fertilizer, possibly even a humate application on there to really get the soil built back up and ready for the next year. And it's amazing what that humate will do. I mean, don't have to water as much. Your lawn just looks great. It's thick, you know, nice, heavy root system.
You know, I've heard so many times over the years that if you only do one fertilizer, make it the last one in the fall.
Year.
And every time I don't do it, I regret it the next year. And so last year I made sure that I put that on because the year before, that was still a hot summer the lawn just looked just kind of sickly all summer.
Yep.
This summer, even though I watered the same and if anything, the temperatures were a little bit warmer.
Yeah,
my lawn looks so much better.
Yeah.
It just was able to take the heat.
Yeah,
because I put on the nitrogen. It must have been end of October sometime.
Yeah, yeah. We're usually recommending around Halloween. You know, between Halloween and Thanksgiving. But I mean, you could do it right now, and it makes such a big difference because that slow release nitrogen will sit there and feed the grass all winter long. It really helps develop root system, really helps get a nice stem growth on the grass as well too. It'll really build the grass back up and get it ready for the next growing season. And it does that all through the dormant season. So, you know, as the grass is starting to go to sleep, starting to go dormant for the winter time, we can aerate, throw that winterizer fertilizer on, and you know, all those plugs that you pull out in the fall, they disintegrate through the winter time, so you don't have to rake those up and clean them up. They don't make a big mess all over the place. I mean, they're out there for a while, but if you do it late enough in the season, they all just kind of disappear over the winter time, and they're gone. So that's a really nice way to do it. And you know, by aerating in the fall, it allows water to penetrate in better. It allows nutrient to penetrate deeper into the soil. You get that aerification where you get the air getting down into the soil as well too, so you get more root growth, and it's really very, very beneficial for your lawn.
How often should you aerate? I mean, should you only be doing it if there's a certain area that you walk on all the time, or?
You know, that's a good question. Depends on your soil. It really depends on your soil type. If your soil's a heavier clay and it tends to compact down a lot and you walk on it and it feels like concrete, you may have to aerate every year to really alleviate that problem. And the best way to improve that over time is, after aerating, add a little organic matter into your soil, and over time, gradually, it won't be so much clay. It'll gradually incorporate that organic matter into the soil. So just a top dressing of a light compost, you know, something finely ground bark, you know, any type of organic matter compost would be really good. Try and stay away from manure composts. It can cause problems in the lawn, and
add seeds.
Yeah, it really doesn't smell great either on the lawn.
Says your dog.
So
probably love it.
Yeah. So there's some good options out there for top dressing the lawn, and it'll work its way down into those holes where you've aerated, and gradually improve your soil over time. One of my favorites is a product that's called Utilite, and the Utilite has zeolite and peat moss and, you know, a lot of organic matter in it as well too, and it really gets down into your soil, helps the soil retain more moisture, helps with drainage, and that's something that I have done to my lawn the last probably 5 or 6 years, because we had to bring a lot of clay in for some fill. We weren't planning on bringing clay in, but that's just kind of what showed up, you know. So so we've been kind of dealing with that over the last 6 or 7 years, and gradually it's getting better and better and better, and to the point where that's probably one of the best parts of my lawn now. Yeah, so it just takes a little bit of time, but we've been aerating that area yearly and then adding the Utilite to it as well, and just over time that's really becoming one of the best places in my yard. Yeah.
We just had a shy violet who didn't want to go on the air who wants to know about wild violet.
Yeah.
And since we're still in the lawn, because I've got wild violets all over my front lawn, and I got them taken care of using your recommendations, I thought. And so, but this was like over a couple of years, and all of a sudden I noticed one little one popping up. And then but now within 3 years, it's all back again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
My daughter still says, "Oh, Daddy, don't take those out. Those are pretty." And it's like, if you want to take care of them, go right ahead.
They are quite pretty, but they're also very aggressive. And so they spread like crazy.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, it's an actual perennial plant that you can purchase at, you know, a nursery, and incorporate into your yard. No, they're very pretty, and they're very resilient. They're very hardy. They bloom for a long time. I mean, it's a nice perennial, but they're very invasive.
But all you end up with is a couple of blades of grass and all violet.
Yeah, in your lawn.
Yes.
But if you keep it contained in your flower beds, it can be a really nice ground cover, but it's just super invasive and spreads everywhere. So once you get it into your lawn, it's actually very difficult to control. It's one of the hardest weeds to get rid of in your lawn.
Would you say it's even worse than field bindweed?
I would say it's worse than field bindweed for
sure.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, because the field bindweed, we can kill quite easily with the weed-free zone. I mean, that does an amazing job on morning glory or field bindweed. But the wild violets are much more resilient. They're really tough. So we've usually had to wait till fall to get our best results. So usually in September and October is when we're getting our best results on controlling those wild violets. And then between the weed-free zone, which is a real quick herbicide, and it knocks down plants, you know, faster than anything I've ever used, and it works on some of the hardest to kill weeds. But between that and another herbicide that's called triclopyr, that's its official chemical name, but its common name is called Turflon. Turflon does a really good job on some of these difficult,
and I think that's what I use
really
last
hard
time,
to kill. So. Yeah, so that's what you see in say brush and stump killer from Fertilome. That's the active ingredients, the Turflon, and Spurge Power from Monterey. That's a really good product as well too. That has the Turflon in it.
So isn't the triclopyr also in the weed free zone?
No.
Okay.
A little bit different. So the weed free zone is a combination of Trimec, which has three different weed killers in it. So it's got 2,4-D, dicamba, and MCPP. And the combination is very effective on most of your weeds, but there's a few that it just doesn't quite get. So they've added another ingredient into the weed free zone, which is called carfentrazone, hence the name weed free zone. That's where the zone part comes in. The carfentrazone, very, very effective on difficult to control weeds. And also works in very cool temperatures. So even if your daytime temperatures are in the high 40s, you can still use the weed-free zone, and it works great. So
what about the triclopyr?
Triclopyr doesn't work quite as well in the cooler temperatures. It's slower. It takes more time to do its job. But it's probably more effective on some of those extremely difficult to control weeds than anything else we've used. So
I know it's usually, if I remember right, it's a lot more expensive than the other, but it's more effective. So maybe if you've got a spot that hasn't been working quite as well because you've got violets and others that are in there, then use the one that has the triclopyr in it.
Right.
Otherwise, the weed-free zone usually takes care of.
Weed-free zone takes care of almost everything, but the violets are a little bit different story. They are really tough to control. And generally, it takes a couple applications. One just doesn't quite get them. So you spray once, wait about a week or 10 days, go back and hit it again, and you should have very good results that way.
Well, and if I do it now, I'm probably not going to be able to spray that second time. I'll have to wait until spring.
You might even have to wait
until
spring. Yeah. But what's nice about controlling weeds in the fall is those plants are going into dormancy. They're trying to take all that energy that they've got in their leaf structure and run it down the root system and store it up for winter time. And so if we introduce an herbicide into that mix while they're starting to store that energy, they'll take it down the root system with it, with all that nutrient and water that they're going to, you know, retain in their core of their plant to make it through the winter time. They'll just pull that herbicide right down with it, and it kills them.
So I don't usually use an herbicide, but when it comes to certain perennial weeds, I just throw that mantra out the window.
Yeah.
I used a weed-free zone on I had a ton of morning glory just working into my garden, and I just went to town with it.
Yeah.
And I can tell exactly where I missed it.
Yeah.
There's one spot right in the middle
that
I missed with my sweep of my arm, and it's the only green spot because everything else is pretty well gone. Some of the prickly lettuce.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to hit with
something
else.
Might have to hit
it
again, yeah.
Yeah, because it killed the top, but it didn't go much further. But I was really shocked with the bindweed, how well it did. Now, did it just kill the top, or did it actually?
Oh no, it'll absorb it in, run it down the root system, especially in the fall.
Because I noticed it yellowing within a day. Oh, it was already starting to go.
Within 24 hours, you'll see it yellowing up, and that's kind of how the carfentrazone works. But it is systemic, and it's also very quick acting systemically. So when you apply that, within 2 hours, it's already absorbed it in, and it's starting to, you know, translocate that through the entire plant. So it's got a very quick reaction time because of the way it's formulated. Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden. He'll be with us for the rest of the program. Right now, we're going to hear a little bit from Petals of Prose. Helen Cannon is a former English teacher, a great friend of Utah Public Radio, and a great writer. And you're going to be hearing a little bit from her right now with Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. The last time I read for the Zesty Garden, I had been talking about Gertrude Jekyll. And before that, I had talked about Vita Sackville-West, two British gardeners looking at quite aristocratic gardens. Now I'm turning to simpler gardens, this time on the west coast of Canada in the 1800s. But before I do that, I wanted to remind you of the piece on zinnias that Vita Sackville West read. She had had a gardening column in the London Times, and she wrote one piece on botanical howlers where the writer is way off base in something he or she's writing about. In this case, Walter Pater, the famous British person with emphasis on aesthetics, had written a book called Marius the Epicurean. And in that book, he had a Roman in his toga pinning a zinnia to his toga. And Vita Sackville West points out that the zinnia hadn't been hybridized for some 12 centuries later. In fact, he was enriching Rome by a flower from a continent not due for discovering for some 1,200 years later. I suppose, she says, this must be granted under the heading poetic license. Well, one of my listeners, a former student, reminded me that I had given her a poem by Ken Brewer, the, at that time, poet laureate of Utah. He and his wife, Bobby, were our next-door neighbors, and her gardens were colorful and beautiful. And sadly, it turned out that Ken was battling a terrible cancer. This is his poem called Zinnias Next to My Bed for Bobby. Yesterday, I was surprised by my wife with a vase on the table next to my bed and full of red, pink, and orange zinnias from our yard. Immediately, the room came to life. A brightness lodged within me, zinnias covering each spot of drab cancer. Tonight, sleepless after my first chemotherapy, I see the flowers each time I check the clock. When finally I sleep, I know I will awaken to zinnias, zinnias, zinnias. That was Ken Brewer's poem written on November 13, 2005. This could also be called not just Petals and Prose, but Petals and Poetry. I'm going to turn to another poem by a very famous Irish poet who died a few weeks ago, Seamus Heaney, a wonderful poet and a wonderful man. One of his friends and colleagues had written about him. Seamus Heaney's funeral in Dublin was televised live, marking an event that occupied the front pages in Ireland for several days. In his eulogy of the poet, Paul Muldoon told the story of being asked at customs on his arrival for the funeral what he did for a living. When he replied that he taught poetry, the customs officer said, "Oh, you must be devastated." No need to say why. The loss of the poet was felt everywhere. He had visited schools and given readings in almost every corner of the country, often for nothing. Thousands of people had seen him on television or had read of his Nobel Prize. The bleak fact that there would be no next volume of his poetry was grief to his readers, but even those who knew his work best were mourning the man as much as the poet. So this is a poem by Seamus Heaney called Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean, rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through the potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee, was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down, down, down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mold, the squelch and sap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. And this brings me to thoughts about the metaphors that are shared by literature and gardening. I've been reading a book called Garden Plots, and you can have plots to a mystery novel or a story, and you can have plots of land. You can have seeds of thought and the scratch of the pen and the scratch of the hoe. You can talk about thorny issues, and things can be transplanted. As I said, I've been reading a book about garden plots by Shelley Boyd, and in it, she considers some early Canadian gardeners, among them Susanna Moody and her sister, Catherine Parr Traill. They married friends and came from England to the west coast of Canada, where they immediately started gardens. And though these were not the lavish gardens like Vita's at Sissinghurst, nor all of the gardens that Gertrude Jekyll planned for people, well over 300 gardens, these were gardens of necessity for the most part. But they also, because these women were British, hearkened back to, there was kind of an archetypal presence in their minds, apparently, of the British cottage garden. And so the gardens that they created were of the cottage garden sort. And I interrupt myself here to say my garden is essentially a cottage garden, and I feel apologetic about it because a cottage garden doesn't belong in the desert. And I know that. I'm just too tired, really, to xeriscape our place and plant desert things. Also, I happen to love the plants in my garden. The affinity between gardening and writing is something that garden historians and theorists, as well as authors, have promoted for decades. Gardens are rhetorical landscapes. They are made of the same materials as all the rest, just as the rhetorician's words are given by language, but they are composed to instruct and move and delight. Because the garden functions as a kind of readable text, it follows that not only plants thrive with it, but also thorny issues of class, gender, religion, and politics. Those values and ideologies pertaining to the social context from which the garden takes its form. A Canadian example of this kind of rhetorical analysis of actual gardens can be seen in Rhetoric and Roses, A History of Canadian Gardening. So these two sisters wrote to each other about their gardens, and it's quite revelatory of how their gardens must have looked. In the spring of 1839, Susanna Moody, a middle-class British immigrant, found herself living alone in the backwoods of Upper Canada, her husband John employed by the militia to pay the family's financial debts. Writing a wedding anniversary letter to her absent husband, Moody recounts how there were court writs against their cattle and how the children were rather ragged and bare without proper clothing. She included an imperative request of her own. "You must send me a pair of India rubber shoes to garden in, for I am without." Moody's sister, Catherine Parr Traill, shared the sentiment. A garden was indispensable. In Traill's Pioneer Manual, The Canadian Settler's Guide, readers learn practical gardening tips before they are educated in the essential task of making bread. Traill promoted gardening among the public and at the same time took personal advantage of those publishing opportunities, as she reveals in an 1882 letter addressed to her son William. Quote, "I get some things from Vic of Rochester and write for his illustrated magazine, and he sends me seeds for pay. I have sent him $15, subscriptions for his magazine since last May. I bless you in my heart." Paid in seedlings for her writing, Traill bestows tremendous material value on the garden. While both sisters view these terrains as vital to their daily lives, critics largely ignore this aspect of their domestic environs, even when the scholarship focuses on landscape and landscape's aesthetics. The majority of critics tend to discuss Moody Trail's physical and intellectual processing of the environment on a grand scale, but an argument can also be made for the centrality of the garden to the sister's expression of the female immigrant experience. This book continues to look at their gardening practice, to present the letters that they wrote to each other about their gardens. And so it's a book that I recommend to you as a very interesting view of early Canadian gardeners. And soon I will turn to gardeners on our own continent. It's been a pleasure to talk with you about these things and to think about them far beyond what I've been able to share. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the USU Army ROTC Wounded Warrior 5K, October 19th. Proceeds to benefit training efforts, including uniforms and training aids. Registration and check-in at 9 a.m. The cannon fires and race starts at 10 a.m. Details at usu.edu/ArmyROTC.
Create an outdoor fall container made of items harvested from your landscape. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Take a walk through your landscape and look for items that look good through fall and winter in your garden. These will make great additions in your fall container. Fill a plastic, fiberglass, or other weatherproof container with sand or soil. Use wire to anchor heavier items. Stick colorful twigs of red and yellow twig dogwood and birch or contorted branches of Harry Lauder's walking stick and corkscrew willow into the soil to provide structure. Add some color with the red fruit of sumac, rose hips, orange berries of mountain ash, and crab apples. Fill in with seed pods of Siberian iris and daylilies, as well as cone flowers and rudbeckias and dried hydrangea flowers. Add a bit of texture and motion with the airy seed heads of ornamental grasses. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Welcome back to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me for the next 15 minutes is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And we would love to have your questions or comments. Right now, all we have is the 800 number. I can't get into this computer, so call us at 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Now, we did have another question that came in from Kathy from Hyde Park. She wants to know, what is a semi-fast growing shade tree without aphids and helicopters and is just it's just clean, providing shade, and it's very colorful.
And very, very colorful.
And we were discussing this over the break and going, well,
as a tall order to fill. There are some nice trees out there that are fairly quick growing that do have nice color, but there's not many that really don't get aphids. Some of my particular favorites, helicopters would be seeds.
The seeds
also, yeah. So for the listeners who don't know what helicopters are, there's a seed that comes off of most of the maples that kind of falls down and looks like
a
helicopter.
And I used to play with those. You break them open and then just kind of open the ends a little bit and you can stick them on your nose.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I remember doing that in grade school too. Aphids are kind of a problem, and they were horrendous this year. They were a real problem for almost everybody this year. Purple ash is one of my favorite trees. It's a very colorful fall color. It's kind of a reddish purple where most of your green ash will turn yellow in the fall. And the ash can get aphids, but they're not as bad as, like, say, maples or lindens or plums or, you know, the whole plum family. So all your flowering cherries, flowering plum, you know, any of those, very colorful in the fall, but they all get
aphids. Ash is a little bit different. I mean, everybody plants maples. Yeah. Everybody plants lindens. I'm like, I want something different.
Yeah, so ash are really nice trees. Green ash are a little susceptible to borers, but the purple ash are much less likely to get borers. In fact, they're very resistant to the borers. You don't see them very often. The only tree that I'm really aware of that does not get aphids at all is ginkgo. And the ginkgos are gorgeous in the fall. I mean, beautiful yellow fall color. The great thing about the best thing about ginkgos, other than they don't get any insects, and there's no natural predator that bothers the ginkgos.
That's why they've survived for tens of millennia. Of
years. Yeah, yeah, millennia. They drop their leaves almost overnight, all of them. I mean, they'll be fully leaved, full glorious fall, golden color, and the next day you go out there, and there's not a leaf left on the tree. It's just like,
then you can get them raked.
And you get them all in one shot. Yeah, which is great. My other favorite tree, which is very desirable to the aphids, unfortunately, is beech. I've got a copper beech at my house, and I've got a fern leaf beech, and I've got a tricolor beech, and they are my three favorite trees in my yard.
I love my beech. I've got a fern leaf beech, yeah, and I've got two European beeches. Yeah. The bizarre thing is I planted all three of them at the same time. The aphids never go to the fern leaf.
Yeah.
The two European beeches are basically on either side of the sidewalk, yeah, and the aphids every year go after the one, and they never touch
the
other one.
Interesting. Yeah,
never even touch it.
Yeah, I don't think I had aphids on my fern leaf beech this year either, but my copper beech gets it every year, and I just treated it once this spring in April with a systemic drench, and I put a little fertilizer and a little iron in with it, you know, so the tree looks really good through the summertime. It didn't have one aphid on it.
Hmm.
I mean, they started to. You could see where they started, and then I went out there and looked, and there was just dead bodies. It just completely took care of them. So I didn't have any curling, didn't have any sap dripping off of it.
And the problem with it is that the beeches get those woolly aphids.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you can't, you can't really spray the tree.
They're fuzzy,
although I did see, not this year, but last year, we had northern orioles. They kept coming in, and they were eating them all the time. So that was kind of fun for a couple weeks.
There's another tree that Kathy might be interested in that's called a Zelkova. Zelkovas are kind of vase shaped, so they're definitely kind of triangular with the point down, and then more blocky up on top. So it's definitely more of a vase shaped tree, kind of a serrated edge. They look kind of like elms. The leaves do, so kind of an elm looking leaf, but very resilient tree, a great urban tree. They do great in street areas. They can handle a lot of different climatic conditions as well too, and I don't think the aphids really go after those too much either. So that's a possibility.
Okay, so I'm going to bring this one up, and you say it does get aphids, but I just love it so much. I planted a horse chestnut,
yeah,
Fort McNair, and they have pink blossoms.
Pink flowers, yeah.
Not white, but pink. And yeah, I always get tons of comments on it, and they stay on the tree for so long. And it's been, see, my daughter's 19. We planted it when she was 8. So it's been in the ground for 11 years.
Yeah.
And it's about now 10, 12 feet tall, and I haven't gotten any aphids in it yet, but the nice thing is you said it's sterile. The pink ones are sterile, so you don't get the...
You don't get the fruits that come off of it that look like landmines.
Yeah, so it's like, I wouldn't call it fast growing. They don't necessarily want a fast grow, but... Yeah.
I guess they don't look like landmines. They look like the mines that they put in the ocean.
In the ocean,
Yeah. But they've got the big spikes on them, so big spiky balls. There's another red flowering variety of chestnut that is called Briote, and it's a little smaller, but very colorful flowers, and it doesn't produce any fruit either. So that's a nice tree.
That is a concern for me. I'm looking at this. Okay, I put it at a spot where I knew it could get big, but when it gets really big, I'm not going to have any sunlight in the backyard.
You see horse chestnuts back east that are like 50, 60 feet tall. Yeah, it's not going to grow that big around here. You'll probably max out about 30 feet.
Like I say, now we had one when I grew up in Mendon, just the regular horse chestnut, that was humongous.
Those get bigger, your red flowering ones are going to be much smaller.
Okay, that's good, because I don't want it to get too large.
It's not going
to
be so big, But I know back east you get in the Midwest and Ohio and Illinois, and some of those trees are like 80 feet tall. Yeah, they're huge.
Great
wood. Yeah, they're
hard
wood. They're big trees.
We have about 10 minutes left in the program. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Our next question comes from Joe in Logan. Hi, Joe. How can we help?
Hey, sorry to take you back to a lawn question.
Oh, you're fine.
But my grass seems to have gone dormant and or dead. And I sent you a picture on Facebook, but Bennett in the office there said you guys' computers aren't working.
Yeah.
Any suggestions? I was actually going to come down and see you today over lunch.
Yeah. Within the last 3 weeks, we have seen an outbreak of sod webworms.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's really late. So, I mean, really late this year. And
is it just all the heat built them up?
And... I don't think so, because I really saw the moths, the adults, out flying around end of July, right. First part of August, right. Like they normally do. And then usually it's like 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later, you've got that outbreak of sod webworm showing up around the first part of September. But this year, it's been super late. In fact, my father had some in his front lawn that we just noticed last week and went there. It's like, man, your grass is kind of turning yellow in some of these spots. And so he just like pulled back on it, and the sod webworms were just down there nibbling away. And so the only good thing about sod webworms is they don't damage the root system. They just chew the grass off right where it comes out of the soil. So in most cases, it will come back.
Okay.
But you might see even larger dead patches next spring, unfortunately, because the grass will die out through the winter time, and it takes a couple months in the spring to get that grass to come back. So what I would suggest you do is where it's looking really patchy like that, go out there and grab it with your hand and pull up on the grass. And if you've had webworm damage, it will pull up just like grass clippings, like clumps of grass, right. Clippings, they'll just pull up really easy. In a lot of cases, you can see the little worms right along the surface of the soil. So right along the soil line, you'll find about an inch long, maybe 3/4 inch long, very narrow, skinny caterpillars that are just munching on the grass. I have some very safe, very effective insecticides we can put on there that will kill them within 24 hours, stop the damage, and then we'll just kind of have to wait and see how it goes for next spring and get your grass coming back again at that point. So,
well, hey, thanks, Mark. I'll probably see you.
You're
this
welcome.
Afternoon.
Come in and see us.
All right. Good All luck. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We do need to make sure we talk about bulbs.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
That was in the open to the program, and so you can still get bulbs in.
Oh,
in fact,
yeah.
I've put bulbs in as late as the day before it snowed.
Yeah,
so.
This is prime time for bulbs, and this is an excellent time to.
Can you still find them?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I've got a great selection right now. So, tulips, daffodils, hyacinths, crocus. And there's a lot of other mixed bulbs, alliums, and crown imperials. You know, fritillaria you can put in right now. And I've actually got a really good selection. I'm starting to get low on some varieties for sure, but you know. Dutch bulbs, the bulbs from Holland, the largest size you can get. The bigger the bulb, the larger your flower is going to be. And it's like you don't even have to have a green thumb to plant bulbs. I mean, it's like one of the easiest things you can do. You just have to plan ahead, because if you don't plant them now, you won't be able to enjoy them next spring. So this is something you got to plant in the fall so that they'll bloom in the springtime. You'll be able to enjoy the flowers through April and May. But, I mean, once you dig the hole, put a little fertilizer down the bottom, put your bulbs in, cover them up, make sure and water them really well.
Now, what kind of fertilizer do you suggest putting in? I usually just stick in bone meal.
Bone meal's great. Yeah, okay. Bone meal's
are
really
pretty cheap.
It's inexpensive. It's a slow-release natural phosphorus fertilizer. It lasts for years, and so it's a great way to fertilize your bulbs. You know, Dutch bulb food's great. There's a lot of different varieties of bulb food that are excellent out there. But the key is when you dig your holes, you can dig small holes, put one bulb in. You can dig big holes, put, you know, 15 bulbs in each hole. I mean, it doesn't really matter. You can do it however you want. Just make sure that the bulbs aren't touching each other, so they have a little bit of space between each other, and a little bit of fertilizer down the bottom of the hole so the roots will grow into the fertilizer. Cover them up.
And but you don't want the bulb sitting on the fertilizer, do you?
You know, I will actually dig my hole with a shovel. I like to do big holes, and I put, you know, 5 to 10 bulbs in each hole. I'll put the fertilizer down the bottom and just kind of work it into the soil just a little bit and put the bulbs right on top of it.
Okay, then that's okay.
Yeah, and then most of your tulips and daffodils and hyacinths are probably about 6 inches deep. You want to go about 6 inches, you know, for the bottom of your hole, and you could go 8, somewhere between 6 and 8 inches. Cover them up. The key is to make sure you water them after you get them planted. If there's not good soil moisture through the fall and the early winter, they will dry up. They'll desiccate. If the soil's dry, it'll actually be drier than the bulb is, and through osmosis, it'll suck the water out of your bulb. And your
bulb's unfortunately, we've had good soil moisture. So.
Yeah, we've had really good soil moisture. So that might not continue. You never know. I mean, it would be nice if we continue to get the storms that we've been getting to build our water supply back up. I think we've had more rain in the last month than we seriously had in the last 6.
Now, the one thing I have noticed, though, in my rain gauge, I'm not getting a whole lot at each time. I get like 8/10.
Yeah,
I get 10ths of an inch,
but it's
500ths.
But it's
enough to keep things going.
It's adding up. So get those bulbs planted. I mean, seriously, after you dig your hole, put your fertilizer in, drop your bulbs in, cover them up, water them. That's it. I mean, they take care of the rest. That's as easy as it gets. And they will put on a great show next spring. I think I've got 65 different kinds of tulips, and I've got 20 different kinds of hyacinths. And
I love hyacinths.
Hyacinths
are always
great.
My favorite, because I love the fragrance outside.
Yeah.
In the house, it's a little strong, but when the hyacinth pops up, they can always, my kids can always see their dad kneeling over and sniffing.
Yeah. Just remember that the deer love the tulips, so you have to do something to repel the deer, you know, net them or cover them or something if you have deer in your neighborhood. Daffodils, they won't touch them. They are poisonous, and the deer won't eat them, and they don't taste very good.
We have one quick question we're going to try to get in. Anita from Providence. Hi, Anita. How can we help?
Oh, hi. I have a Japanese tree lilac.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was the hard wind or what, but I thought it had died.
Yeah.
And so we started cutting off branches this spring, like about June, and all of a sudden I realized that there were some little tiny leaves on them, so we quit cutting. But, you know, there's a little bit of leaves on there. Is there anything I should, it's about 12, 13 years old.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can do to, should do to protect it through the winter?
Yeah, that's a tree that's a slightly marginal. And you're in Providence?
Is
that what you said? Yeah.
Down at the bottom, not up high.
Okay, so you're a little bit cooler then. Those Japanese lilacs, they are gorgeous when they bloom. They're really pretty, but they are a little marginal for our area, so they're not 100% hardy for Cache Valley. And definitely prune off anything that looks like it's dead. Something you could do this fall to try and help it with hardiness would be kind of what we do with our roses. We've got a kind of a cocktail we do for our roses with magnesium sulfate and potash. And they're quite inexpensive. You can sprinkle it on the ground around the shrub or the tree, whatever you're trying to make hardy through the winter. And you sprinkle it on the ground, water it in really well. And after that, you know, the magnesium helps it bloom more the next year. The potash really helps the plant pick up and utilize water and other nutrient, and helps with winter hardiness. And so that's probably about the best thing you can do, because it's just all exposed up there on the top. And if it's not in a great location where it's protected from the wind, you know, your wind kind of comes out of the canyons there. And coming from the east. So you got to have a little bit of east and north protection, and that's going to be your best bet.
Okay, I'll try that. Thank you.
All right, good luck.
Thanks, Nita.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And we've got 30 seconds, so amaryllis. The amaryllis are in.
Again,
it's a bulb. The larger size you can get, the bigger the blossoms.
The bigger.
And the more.
Yep, the more flowers you get. I've got some gorgeous colors. I mean, about every color imaginable. And the larger the bulb, the more flowers they produce. So our 40-centimeter size bulbs are so big you almost can't get your hands all the way around them. And they will produce anywhere between 15 and 20 flowers.
That's pretty amazing.
Consistently. I mean, that's like average. Sometimes you get a little bit more. And the flowers are massive, and it takes about 6 weeks, 8 weeks for them to bloom.
So if you start them now,
they're going to be, you know, blooming maybe a little bit before Christmas, but they'll bloom for 4 to 6 weeks. And so you can have them bloom all the way through the holiday season. And if you want something blooming after the holidays, they make great gifts. You know, they make awesome gifts, and a lot of different colors, double flowers, single flowers, oranges, reds, you know, mixed colors, pinks, purples, gorgeous.
I love Orange Sovereign.
Yeah,
that's
orange
my favorite.
Sovereign's tough. Yeah.
Well, Mark, we've reached the end of the time. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson has been my guest. He's from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And thank you for joining us on this edition of The Zesty Garden.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Stay with us for Performance Today. Coming up next, followed by Exploring Music at 1. The time now is 11 o'clock.